to contemplative art, rather obviously, Kant has an overly moralized conception of art, and I despise that. But nonetheless, when I read Kant on art, I am intrigued. So that means that I think it's an internally complex account, and therefore I want to develop a reading strategy for looking at Kant on art that will release what I think is deep and still with us in his account, that is Kant as a radical modernist. That's the assertion I want to make. And see if I can do it. Well, it's clear that the position of art in Kant must be fraught. After all, internally, the whole theory, Kant's whole aesthetic theory, is a reception aesthetic. And obviously, the question of art sits uneasily in that context. Art always has to have at least a moment concerning production and creation, and therefore, what is an aesthetic that is a reception aesthetic, judgments of taste, to do with it? Further, just to ratchet up the difficulties, Kant's aesthetic is one geared to natural beauty. Hence, he is having to squeeze his account of art into the context of natural beauty, which, on the face of it, seems perverse. Indeed, so perverse is it that we know that Hegel went in the other direction and claimed that philosophical aesthetics should be a philosophy of art with natural beauty dependent on its fit with it. That there is no such thing as natural beauty, but rather a deficient mode of art beauty. And for what it's worth, within the history of aesthetics, Hegel has triumphed. Indeed, triumphed so radically that some critics, like Noel Carroll, who I consider a world historical nincompoop, deny Kant that has a philosophy of art at all, and that therefore Kant is useless for contemporary purposes. Well, I think there is an interesting leitmotif that runs right through Kant's theory of art, namely about a notion of meaning or meaningfulness beyond determinate discursive meaning. That is, a notion of meaning beyond rational meaning, a notion of meaning that is not secured in independence of the material world, but in conjunction with it. And indeed, that seems to me to run right through his account. And I want to find a way of bringing that theme up to a level of perspicuousness so that the moralizing view disappears. So my strategy is going to read the entire section on the aesthetic backwards. By which I mean, I want to start with paragraph 51, which is the account of the division of the fine arts. I will then turn, after discussing it, to an account of aesthetic ideas. And only finally, as a last step, do I want to read those two moments in the context of Kant's claim that art is beautiful when it appears like nature, a deeply puzzling claim, and I want to then think about all of that by thinking about his account of genius, which is obviously at the center of his account. But I take it that the notion of genius is so peculiar and so odd that it's really hard to make sense of. My first and opening gambit, I should say, the account of Kant on the division of arts, will be playing off of an account in an unpublished paper by my friend Greg Horowitz. So I am borrowing from a paper he gave in Berkeley a couple of years ago that struck me as useful here. Okay, paragraph 51 then. After again repeating his claim that beauty, whether natural or artistic, I'm going to come back to this sentence, is the expression of aesthetic ideas, Kant says that if we wish to divide the fine arts, we can choose for this, at least tentatively, no more convenient principle than the analogy between the arts and the way people express themselves in speech so as to communicate with one another as perfectly as possible. So the opening thought is the idea of, let's call it, perfect communication. Namely, he goes on to say, what is perfect communication? And what he says is surprising. He says perfect communication is not merely as regards their concepts, but also as regards their sensations. That is, perfect communication would be now complete communication of everything you are thinking and feeling and experiencing to another. Such expression, he says, consists in word, gesture, and tone. And then in parenthesis he says, articulation, gesticulation, and modulation. Only when these three ways of expressing himself are combined, does the speaker communicate completely. For in this way, thought, intuition, and sensation are conveyed to others simultaneously and in unison. So the beginning here is surprising, and it's surprising because the notion of complete communication ignores all of Kant's usual divisions between mind and body, between reason and intuition, between intuitions and sensations, and thinks that communication, if it's to be fully successful and complete, would have to be something that unified all of these and simultaneously communicated them. This is, and Kant, in a way, is going to insist upon it, an impossible ideal. And its impossibility is our interest. Hence, he goes on to say, there are only three kinds of fine arts. The arts of speech, call it literature. Visual art, which is what he thinks picks up the notion of gesture. And the art of the play of sensations. Think of that as primarily music. So the notion of, and here is what is interesting, Kant is not interested in a unitary, he's not going to give an account that says, here is art in general, and here are the modes of art. Rather, he is going to think of art as essentially divided, not to be unified, not to be systematized, and that the division is primary because the plurality of art arises out of an already divided or self-dividing sphere of communication. So Kant's interest here is in the plurality of arts. Why are there a plurality of arts? What is it about our communicative interests that require that there be a plurality of arts and not just one? And what are the stakes of art in light of the fact that there are a plurality of arts? We can say that the artist who would be perfectly anti-Kantian here, therefore, would be Wagner. Right? He would be the idiot, which I take, again, to be right. That is, I despise Wagner, but I'll go there. But I take it that there's something deep about the plurality of the arts. And I think that there's something deep in Kant's thoughts that we think about this plurality as part of the irreducibility of the principles that require the differentiation of the arts. So, in the notion of, and here's the surprising thought for Kant at least, in thinking about the idea of perfect or complete communication, Kant is giving normative force and normative authority to what necessarily remains unarticulated or unspoken within the abstract concept. You look puzzled, right? If complete communication involves both concept, intuition, and sensation, if that's the image of complete communication he's offering, then the idea of complete communication assumes there is more to be communicated than what gets communicated by concepts themselves. So the idea of complete communication is already itself a kind of normative or abstract ideal that licenses us in taking seriously what gets unsaid, unspoken, in ordinary conceptual determination, say in a philosophy lecture. So the idealizing device he uses to sort through the many arts is this notion of perfect or complete communication. And he makes clear by his references to sensation as distinct from thought and concept that the idea of perfect communication is not to be thought of as the clarification of all possible mental concepts, I'm sorry, mental contents by means of better or more capacious concepts. He does not mean, therefore, that the making explicit of the content of the communication by conceptual means, everything that Bob Random wants in making it explicit, the perfectly perspicuous account, right, of all the inferential commitments involved in a saying, that is not perfect communication or complete communication. Rather, complete communication communicates contents that are significant in their residual sensational aspects. That is, in their non-identity to the concepts they color and inflect. Communication, you might say, is perfect in this light when it also conveys what is not mediated by concepts. So if science, and if you wish, philosophy, depends how you want to look at philosophy, as whether on the side of science or the side of art, but if science is the idea of what can be made conceptually determinate, and in the dialectic of the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant says that the goal of the progress of science is complete conceptual determinacy. That is, for any concept to be able to say whether it falls under or not any other concept. If that's what science is, then Kant is here opening up the possibility of a form of communication and therefore a form of expression and therefore a form of meaning other than that of perfectly rational, conceptually determinate meaning. Hence, there is art because the ideal of communication, of making oneself completely understood socially, requires the social acknowledgement of what cannot be made explicit in communication. We have art because our ordinary communications fail to communicate, I might even say, what is most important.
So Pippin and Ginsberg, in each of their articles, come with this feeling of white aesthetic judgments. And it's not a capacity, but it's something that we have to hold ourselves accountable to and weigh in on ourselves. Can you tell me how this kind of social acknowledgement relates to that?
Great question. I am trying, here Kant is providing a motive and rationale for art that is independent at this point, this is why I'm working backwards, of the normative authority of reflective judgment and therefore of the beautiful. I'm coming up with, or I'm here suggesting, that he flags here a new or different normative ideal. Complete communication. And that complete communication as an ideal is an acknowledgement of what remains blocked or incomplete, even if the conceptual content of the communication is perfectly explicit and clear. So think about those times when you ask someone a kind of probing question, and they give you a perfectly reasonable answer. You say, "Yeah, I know that, but what do you really think?" Right? That you're assuming that whatever they've said isn't adequate to, let's say, the weight or the significance of what's going on. That something has been left uncommunicated in their perfectly rational communication. Yeah?
This may seem from left field. So would this reading of communication... First of all, how does this reading of communication relate to communicability? In a sense, it's communist. And would this resist Arendt's appropriation of Kant for the political?
Elaborate the last one.
Well, in other words, the political can't be esoteric in the sense of trying to communicate the uncommunicable, right? It has to be, I guess she wants the notion of plurality more than that. I don't know.
Wouldn't it be something like same as your first question, wouldn't this new normative ideal potentially jeopardize the possibility of the census communism? The restrictive
character. That would be a better way.
Well, what it would do would be to it would destabilize any census communis, for sure. That is, because it has a permanent interest in the thought that there is a deficit of communication built into communicability.
Right?
That's the thesis. There's a deficit of communication built into the communicability. And that art is going to be the means, the mechanism, the acknowledgement of the displaced and unacknowledged meanings that are at stake in communication but have been left uncommunicated. And there will be as many arts, we might say, as there are displaced or unacknowledged meanings. So that this is about the way in which the absence of meaning, the failures of meaning, the deficits in meaning, the meanings we have are always less than the meanings we need, and that the meanings we need cannot be fully made explicit, and art is the repository for those unspoken. That's certainly the thought here. Would that jeopardize a sensus communis or engender a different one? I don't know. But it changes the story about communication, sure.
How do you have an ideal of something that by its very nature is not ideal?
Come on.
No, because you're stipulating an ideal, which is like, you know, the perfect communication for these three types, right? But the thing is, as you're saying this, it's like, by its very nature...
Impossible ideal.
Yeah, by its very nature, communication is not able.
You can either bite the bullet on this or repudiate it. It's a standard notion of ideal, whether it's the moral law... Or, I would argue, every notion in natural science, read Nancy Cartwright, a frictionless surface. There are none! But we cannot do science without it. I mean, all of science, natural science, rests on idealizations of impossible states of affairs.
But the thing is, then the ideal is not that which is built up in order to get the ideal. You know, then the experience of the communication is not... actually what generates the ideal. The ideal is like stipulated before that and then we...
No, it's the other way around.
Okay.
That's what I'm suggesting.
Okay.
That's great. I am suggesting it is the experience of the failures of communication, even in the most explicit communication, that generates an idea or ideal of perfect communication, right? That we then have, as I'm now suggesting, as a critical impetus against pure conceptuality.
How do we have it if it's never been reached by the actual communication?
It's like many things, by its absence.
But just because there isn't the perfect friend on earth. Whatever it says in the Metaphysics of Morals, just because there isn't the perfect friend on earth doesn't mean there isn't the perfect friend.
Yeah. I mean, that, it's just that kind of idea. You know, Aristotelians may or may not want that kind of thing. But. Okay. So, the idea is that the arts are sites of disclosure of the uncommunicated elements of social communication... And that their being so can help us to grasp the complexity of the relationship between cognition and affect in art. Because the displaced or unacknowledged meanings given form in art are precisely, and I'm just using for the moment sensations, but gestures would do as well, think of gestures as painting now, sensations, music, but we're just used the phrase sensations for the both of them. Because the displaced or unacknowledged meanings given form in art are precisely meaningful sensations, they cannot be regarded as anything but undischarged demands on understanding. That they demand uptake and acknowledgement by the understanding. So the desire to distinguish affect from concept in order to quarantine affect in the domain of the presentational impact of art may seem to be in the service of the significance of affect to art, but in practice it functions as the abstract concept's last line of defense against the confrontation with its own communicative weakness, which is to say its normative, ethico, and social weakness. What I mean by that is, if you run the concept affect distinction too hard, you're going to give too much to the concept. So it's rather what you want to say is the affect is that aspect of the concept itself that the determinate concept fails to communicate in its own regard. So if you're Kristeven, you're going to say it's the semiotic element of the concept itself that gets lost in its becoming determinate. Yeah?
Is that parallel to the distinction made in the first half between rationality and sublime?
I hope not.
Okay. In that, is it the same structure that the rationality, the sublime is what's, is there some excess that...
Not every excess is the same. Let's that's the whole point here. Let's be very careful. I will want to say that there's a lot to be said about the relationship between art and the sublime. I'll come to that. But let us not just jam together every time we see reason and its other, that there's one thing. The beauty of this account in Kant, I think, is that affect and gesture are not sublime others. They are unacknowledged sources of meaning. That they're bits of communication that have gone astray. That they're bits of social demand that have not been acknowledged. So the unacknowledged meanings at work in communication are taken here to be neither unacknowledgeable nor merely not yet acknowledged, but are demands for response in extremis. That is, response, the provision of which is a matter of historical contingencies that abstraction aims to leave behind. Think of it this way. In Butler's talk this weekend, she said that the notion of descent was something that had to do with rogue speech, and that rogue speech was unspeakable within a regime of discourse, and that it could only appear as unspeakable and perhaps unspoken, or what cannot be spoken, and what demands to be spoken. Well, Kant's interested in a demand of that kind, a demand that is putting absolute pressure on our regimes of existing communication. Now, if this is right, or anything like right, then it explains why Kant's account of the plurality and specificity of the arts explains why there is not and cannot be a system of the arts. There cannot be a system of the arts because the plurality of the specific arts derives from the logical connection between the communicative deficit of the abstract concept and the immeasurable field of displaced meanings. And that is to claim that there is no concept that will permit us to cognize the totality of the arts. Horwitz puts this thought this way. He says, there is not system, but solidarity becomes the right metaphor for the internal relation of the several arts. They testify jointly in their plural specificity to the perpetual need for judgment. So the plural specificity of the arts is an expression of, how do I want to put this? Art's tactlessness, or untimeliness, or provocation, or unjustifiability. That is, art, just like the rogue speech in Butler's Discourse, has about it a necessary tactlessness because it is taking up what has thus far precisely been unacknowledged and in principle is unacknowledgeable by determinate conceptuality. So what art forms reveal are the ways in which, let's call them rogue meanings, press on us despite their not being turned into concept. They don't stop pressing on us. After all, if arts convey both these unacknowledged meanings and their incommensurability to determinate meanings, then they harass us in a certain way. How do I want to put it? What makes the arts tactless or intimate in their communication or feeling like they're harassing us is their untranslatability. That even when the arts are there, those meanings are not then able to be conveyed and made determinate and picked up. No, the arts themselves are the site of the fact that what we have is something like an idiolect that cannot be generalized or further translated. So the plurality of the arts is then what do we want to say? If I guess another word for a meaning that is demanded in the different Lyotard would call the site of a meaning for which there is no word, suffering. So we might say arts are the site of suffering that has not found social expression. And it is perpetual because the artistic expression acknowledges those meanings without finding the ability to translate them or redeem them. That's all surprising, or should be surprising, coming from Kant. The power of the account is, again, surprisingly, the irreducibility of the arts as conveyors of meanings, and not just any meanings, but I'm going to... I want to say that what we do when we create works of art is we create works that can bear the burden of human significance. And I take it that bearing the burden of human significance in the account of the plurality of the arts is given articulation by the idea of uncommunicated meaning. It is given generality in Kant's account by his account of aesthetic ideas. Okay, so let me stop there for a second. Any questions about the plurality of the arts?
Yep. I think there's something about this whole account that seems to me very deep and intuitively attractive. But it seems to me that it almost leaves the art critic looking like a bit of an asshole. I mean, he doesn't really have anything to say if there is a kind of intransigent incommensurability between the meaning communicated by art and our ability to conceptually express what that meaning is. So what is the role of the art critic?
Well, I think I would say the same as I've been saying all semester long. The art critic ultimately is someone who provides access to the works themselves. Doesn't translate out and give them another meaning that can then socially circulate. Rather, the art critic is someone who assumes the idiolect. That was my claim, that there's a kind of idiolectical character about the arts, and that's part of their insinuation, their intimacy, their demandingness. And what they do is they make clear that it is an idiolect, but at least try to provide pathways to it so that it can be encountered. And I would say that's what great critics actually do.
It's this intimate, undischarged meaning that we're already familiar with. Why do we need a critic to provide us access to it?
Because of the notion of form. Form is the idiolect, right? Form is the way, and aesthetic ideas are going to be the way, and that's why I need to go to aesthetic ideas, is the way of taking up and discharging it. But, you know, you read Hamlet, the reasonable question is, well, what undischarged idea is at stake here? And you know, mostly, in my judgment, most of the readings of Hamlet are just way off base. They are avoidances of the play. Right? I want to say this is a play about the impossibility of losing your mother and the father. This is about the sudden experience of subjectivity as emanating out of the sudden loss of the absolute father and the absolute mother. Well, then I have to make a story about how to read this, right? But at the end of the day, you're going to have to experience the play. But so that the form in which, so the aesthetic ideas, I'm going to claim, are mourning and melancholy that are at work in that play, and that the form of the play is going to be, you know, a certain tragedy, a certain narration that has to embody them and give all its consequences and connections, these are all aesthetic acts, and so on and so forth. So that artworks are the occasions on which we can acknowledge and work through at a certain level these undischarged meanings.
We should move on. But I have a discomfort with the way meaning is being used here, because it seems to me meaning is, if anything, something shareable. And so it seems to me paradoxical. Is that
there are different ways of sharing
experience and see what you're talking about. I just don't know how to talk about it. And meaning seems to be...
Right. I think there's a confusion about the notion of shareability. Shareability may mean transferability, or it may mean capable of plural encounter. And I think they're both reasonable notions of shareable. That is, we can both share the experience of the same object, not by communicating directly with one another, but by, as it were, finding ourselves capable of equally being responsive to it and being able to acknowledge our mutual responsiveness to it. So that part of course, there is a kind of coordination or failures of coordination that criticism does, but in relationship to another object. But I do not think, I mean, this is, by the way, this is the problem I have with Dummett's whole philosophy of language. The notion of privacy, the opposite of privacy, is not decontextual translatability. The opposite of privacy is capable of being experienced by another. So otherwise the notion of art is sunk. And the notion of non-discursive cognition is sunk. Right? If there is such a thing as non-discursive cognition, that is, let's call it cognition, if you wish, by ostension or acquaintance or immediate encounter. If that's a form of cognition, then it has to be capable of being both objective and non-transportable. That would, just going to be true of even the simplest demonstrative.
So, given this account of art, is there, is there the possibility for non-tragic art?
Tragedy is a particular form.
Well, is there a kind of meaning that, kind of untranslatable meaning that wouldn't just be irreducible, the sharing of irreducible suffering or loss?
I'm still not following.
Well, it seemed like
you think comedy is funny? Aristophanes is funny? Aristophanes, the great nihilist, funny. He may laugh, but he's the darkest of playwrights. I'm not denying laughter. I'm not denying lyric poetry. I'm not denying epic. None of that. I don't think there's anything necessarily. But I am saying that there are about ranges of experience. And some of them may be even, heartwarming ones, if you wish. Giving birth. The great poem by John Berryman on Homage to Mrs. Bradstreet, which has the great, great two stanzas of her giving birth. I don't know what it's like to give birth, needless to say, and I never will. Nor did Berryman by that matter. But... it's a remarkable 16 or so lines. I don't know if that's on something. You know, tragic just seems the wrong word. I'm using the notion of suffering formally, okay. not morally.
But there's no art that isn't suffering. It just has to be the case, though, that there's no art that isn't suffering.
Wait, I mean, that was my question, because, you know, the word that can't be said about suffering.
It's because it's about the blockage of meaning. So there is real suffering in the sense of real failures of our ability to, as it were, have exposed those things that need saying. That is, our regime of discourse does make ranges of meaning, right? Unspoken, unspeakable. And I just think that's right. And I think art is the perpetual response to that. That's what I thought.
You might have just pointed to an answer, but I wanted to ask a question about the relegation of affect and sensation to the realm of art. And I'm wondering if that has to be only after the realms of truth and art are separated, or only in the modern community. Like what you just said about sort of the regime of discursivity.
Good. There is only art in the full sense in a non-religious society. Only after there cannot neither be philosophy nor art where there are gods. That just seems to me obvious. So the answer to your question is probably yes. I mean, I take it that, you know, the Greek world was where we think of, you know, art arises as the collapse of the Greek gods. And religious art is not art, it's part of religious ritual. So art as answer to that, what we call art, yeah. And committed to that art, yes.
Yeah. Where's just, you know, techne, pure and simple, in your account? Craft. Finding beauty and making something. And sharing that. I'm wondering, just not an overly sort of intellectual, highbrow conception of our experience of art.
Well, I haven't got to art making yet. Technique for Kant is the body of art, of aesthetic ideas. It's literally the image that Kant uses. But I haven't answered what to worry you. You asked a sly question with a deep meaning, and I answered the question, but not the deep meaning.
Maybe you should think hard about your question. Sorry.
Oh, right, yeah. Let's
You see the problem, right? We explicitly. Pam.
I might be just completely confused here, but you keep talking about, you said the experience of failures of communication generates the idea or the ideal, and you keep talking about what's left out of ordinary communication, but the way Kant introduces this is the analogy between the arts and the way people express themselves in speech so as to communicate with one another, purpose, blah, blah, blah. So he's suggesting there actually is a way that people do communicate in this very cool way that goes beyond just conceptual communication.
It does indeed.
And that's interesting to me. You haven't really talked about that. And that would suggest on that analogy that encountering an artwork is something like encountering a living, expressive, almost sort of being in a very personal one-on-one encounter that has these other aspects to it. And that's just slightly different from the way you seem to be suggesting that this kind of communication doesn't occur.
The reason why is your account leaves out the plurality of the arts. Your account exactly imagines that there is this complete communication ordinarily, and then the arts can mimically follow that by having, you know, and this is the Wagnerian fantasy.
Right.
And I'm suggesting that for Kant, the thought is rather different, that he's aware of course, where you're right, is he's aware that as I'm talking now, I mean, look, I'm sure this happens to every one of you every week. You busily take notes in the course and think you've said just what I said. You go home, makes no sense. Zero. And now, part of that is I'm incoherent, you're a bad note taker. Apart from all that, what's missing is the gestures, the contextualization, the emphases, all the things that allow those words. So, of course, everyday communication involves, and this is what Kant is acknowledging, involves sensational, gestural aspects. But he's equally claiming that our notion of determinate meaning, on his own account, must require, so he's aware that there's a gap between conceptual determinacy and complete communication. Right? That's how he gets the thing going. But rather than thinking, oh, what we need is a reminder of Bernstein's perfect communication, no, well, what happens, rather, is we try to understand, as Ian's trying to understand, right, the subtext that is not getting captured in my continual reiterations of the same bad idea.
You were speaking. I can see how what you're saying applies to some arts, but I would, as you were giving your lecture, I was thinking about kinds of art that attempt to, like realism and still lifes, like it's a painting of a pair on a table. What's the rogue meaning that's sort of being brought into our situation?
Well, I'm going to ask you either today or maybe next week. Kant says, I already read you the passage, that judgments of natural beauty express aesthetic ideas. Same question. So maybe I need to say more about aesthetic ideas before we try. I mean, that's why I want to get there. But he is going to say something has been unexpressed. Right? And that there are reasons why I'm one of these people who love Mirandi, right? I love those paintings of those goddamn bottles. Duh. I mean, you know, or even worse, I adore Agnes Martin. Yeah, come on. So there's a story to be told here, but it's got to be, we need a deeper conception of aesthetic ideas before we get there. Yeah.
Sorry. I'm interested in whether...
about which I've said nothing yet.
I'm interested in kind of history, and whether history is an art which has been left out, or whether history, like what the narratives of history say, and whether it's kind of, you know, a lot of Greeks, it's a lot of the kind of new social historians of the 1960s and after made precisely the same claim about their practice, which was that we're kind of releasing this social suffering, essentially.
It is not an accident, I think, that history and the historical novel arose at almost the same time. These are commensurable discourses that we'd be hard pressed to separate easily. Is that too cute an answer?
I'll think about it.
Okay. Let me try to get started on aesthetic ideas. So I'm working backwards, right? So I'm now back to paragraph 49. Works of art for reasons we'll return to, are produced by genius. At paragraph 49, Kant says that a work can be formally fine, which is nice and elegant, but fail. And he says it will fail because it lacks spirit. What is spirit? Geist. That's the word he uses here. Well, the idea of spirit here is animation. It is play. So animation is the idea of the play, or the harmony again of the imagination and the understanding, and a play that will be self-sustaining. So something about bad works of art and lacking spirit certainly lack that animation. So spirit, he says, in the aesthetic sense, is the animating principle in the mind. Just when you think you got Kant pegged, he just throws in another technical term that makes no sense. But what this principle uses to animate or quicken the soul, the material it employs for this is what imparts to the mental powers a purposive momentum. That is, what imparts to them a play which is such that it sustains itself on its own and even strengthens the powers for such play. And now he says that this principle, that which does the animating of Geist, is the ability to exhibit aesthetic ideas. And then he gives his first definition of aesthetic idea. He says, I mean a presentation of the imagination which prompts much thought, but to which no determinate thought whatsoever, that is, no determinate concept, can be adequate, so that no language can express it completely and allow us to grasp it. It is easy to see that an aesthetic idea is the counterpart, and then for some reason he puts in parentheses, pendant. Why do you do that? Why pendant? Well, I guess the answer is he wants a hierarchy. He wants us to know that he doesn't think aesthetic ideas are as important as rational ideas. So he makes them the pendant, what hangs from those rational ideas. And realizes that the notion of counterpart didn't do it. So he says, pendant. He says, easy, the second is the counterpart of a rational idea, which is conversely a concept to which no intuition, presentation of the imagination can be adequate. So an aesthetic idea is an intuition, but it's unlike any intuition we've yet seen in Kant. It's an intuition that is a bearer of meanings, but a bearer of meanings of such a kind that a presentation to the senses. So a presentation of a particular, an individual one, but this individual one is not awaiting conceptual determination. Rather, it's a source of meanings which no concepts are equal to or capable of fully exposing, just as rational ideas ideas of reason, freedom, the soul, the world as a whole, are ideas for which it is impossible to provide a determinate intuition. At 342, he gives a variety of definitions of these, but 342 is a nice one, too. Halfway down the page, an aesthetic idea, he says, cannot become cognition because it is an intuition of the imagination for which an adequate concept can never be found. A rational idea, conversely, can never become a cognition because it contains a concept of the supersensible for which no adequate intuition can be given. I think we may call aesthetic ideas unexpoundable presentations. I like that a lot. Unexpoundable presentations of the imagination and rational ideas in demonstrable concepts of reason. So Kant's first thought in thinking about aesthetic ideas is simply, as it were, definitional now. They are going to be presentations which, for reasons we've not yet been given, but he is aiming to convince us, cannot themselves be made conceptually determinate or explicit or be captured by a concept. In carrying on his elaboration of aesthetic ideas, so what I'm going to do is just follow his elaboration here in paragraph 49, and then elaborate it to a point of trying to defend it. I want to defend the notion of aesthetic ideas as a good one. I'm not going to be able to do that all today. After giving this original definition of aesthetic idea, Kant then makes a series of elaborations. That's what pages 314 and 315 do. And there are several things he says, and we need to kind of both label each of them and then try to put them together into a consistent package. So the first thing he says is, for the imagination, he says, in its role as productive cognitive power is very mighty when it creates, as it were, another nature out of the material that actual nature gives us. We use it to entertain ourselves when experience strikes us as overly routine. Well, this is actually extremely surprising, because the claim here is that the imagination, in making a second nature, is saying that first nature, that is causal, deterministic, mechanistic nature, can be eclipsed. Which is to say that the mechanisms of first nature can be supervened upon by meanings, and in being supervened upon by meanings, they take on a significance that is in excess, obviously, to natural law, But they also take on a meaningfulness that cannot be made fully determinate. And I take it that the non-arbitrariness of this moment depends on the thought that we have first nature as raw material. So that part of, let's call it, what I'm going to call the transcendental opacity of aesthetic ideas is to be understood as in part dependent upon the fact that the material that aesthetic ideas work upon is the raw material of first nature itself. But to put it that way is to suggest that what is at stake here, at least in part, and I'm going to return to this next week, is in thinking about this notion of second nature, Kant is thinking about aesthetic ideas as a mediation or a suspension of the dualism between freedom and determinism itself. Because, after all, the raw materials, the material stuff, is what is causally determined. And we are going to be able to shape that material in ways in which we suspend the efficacy of those causal laws as giving the full intelligibility of what appears before us. And therefore, what appears before us is something that coheres with our need to express meaning. Then we have subtly, or not so subtly, at least suspended the absolute duality between phenomena and noumena, between freedom and causality. Let me give an example. I can see you all both are tired, hot, and puzzled. Bit of music. Any bit of music is going to depend upon all the ordinary mechanisms of sound waves, you know, instruments causally interacting, sound waves hitting our ears, all that stuff. And yet, certain structuring just of those sounds themselves into melodic, rhythmic structures is going to become the expression of grief. Brahms' violin for chair, something like that. It always makes me cry. Or so it's that power to take that material and suspend its causal meanings into another type of meaning. And a meaning that cannot be detached from the ordering of that material. That is material-dependent meaning. Now, if that's right, it would follow that every artwork, and I suppose this is part of at least the charm of artwork, that artworks are imaginative sublations of nature. That in aesthetic ideas, nature is not merely placed in the light of human freedom, but recreated and liberated from theoretical laws. So that something about art is a demonstration, not merely that we can control nature, we know that all the time, but that nature is not resistant to, but indeed can be a vehicle for our deepest meanings. Indeed, not only a vehicle for them, but the only vehicle by which they can be communicated. So that the realm of nature, rather than being the antagonist, suddenly becomes the indefinite resource for the possibilities of those communications that ordinarily are uncommunicated. Yeah?
Yeah, I'm just a little confused on given nature being kind of already causal. I mean, I thought that in the chain, in the first critique, we have given nature, imagination brings that in, and then the concepts are going to apply causality to that. Is that not correct?
That's not correct. No. Nature is, our concept of an object is necessarily one that is bound by causal laws. That's its condition of intelligibility, of appearing as an object at all. Don't worry about how it happens. That's the fundamental commitment. Right. Now, in certain ways, we always know we can work with those laws. That's what we do when we build a building, right? We use gravity, and we structure it. But this is something else. This is not merely as we're harnessing those powers and redirecting them to human ends. That's what technology is, right? This is thinking of them as meaningful.
Just wondering, sounds a lot like McDowell, the story you're telling. But he kind of tells the same story without art. So what role does art do in sort of making this point about second nature and first nature that's over and above kind of McDowell and McDowell?
McDowell has an insufficient account of first nature, so that he helps himself to the idea of second nature so thoroughly that, in fact, the realm of law becomes a theoretical posit only of interest to, let's call it, the natural sciences. So I guess I would want to say that McDowell's notion of second nature is overly optimistic. Oh, we can talk about that next week. It's already 10:30. Thank you.